Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Omar Al-Tarai, your host and director of research at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm super excited to say we have a special guest on today, Tim Bodner. Tim is a partner in PwC's real estate practice and presently leads PwC's U.S. and global real estate deals businesses. Tim, thank you so much for being on the CRE Exchange.
Thank you for having us, Omar. We appreciate it.
All right, so let's jump in with a bit of background. Tim, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your career journey? What led you to commercial real estate?
Yeah, so I've been in professional services most of my career, other than a stint that I had in industry working for a business in a single family residential space coming out of the financial crisis. I think for me, what took me to this sector was that I found that real estate touched every part of my life. So whether I was traveling on vacation, looking for a place to live, going to work, going shopping, traveling, what have you, somebody owned all those buildings. And for me, it was fascinating to understand why they invested in certain assets and get behind it. And also, the industry is the largest asset class in the world. And I think if you stop to think about that, it just tells you how relevant it is to really every other industry sector, whether it's financial services or healthcare or technology and media and entertainment or sports and live entertainment. There's physical assets that drive all those businesses in different ways. And so for me, that's why I did it. In terms of me specifically, I was born and raised in the suburbs of Chicago, grew up in the suburbs, went to school at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. Met my wife there, moved back to Chicago while she was in medical school and doing her training, and gradually over time found our way out to Washington, D.C., where I am now with three kids, two boys and a little girl.
That's fantastic. That you have your hands full. And one of the things that I noticed is that you're not only focused on your day job, but you're also heavily involved in industry groups, the Real Estate Roundtable and ULI. Can you tell us a bit about those groups and your role?
Yeah, so for those who aren't aware, the Real Estate Roundtable is the industry organization that advocates on behalf of the industry in front of policymakers in Washington, both the administrative branch as well as the Congress. And many of the policies that are driven at a federal level are oftentimes done without full consideration of how it impacts, you know, the industry specifically. And so they're the organization that goes in front of those audiences and explains how we think you ought to look at this and the impact on it. And so for me, that is this very special group of people who do amazing work with a very small staff. And being able to have a relationship with them, explain our thinking around some of these issues, as well as hearing what they're hearing from policymakers and like, is just critical to doing what I do. So that's the Real Estate Roundtable. On the Urban Land Institute, I have a global role. The Urban Land Institute's a global organization with operations across the world. And they, like the Real Estate Roundtable, are on the forefront of issues that are impacting the industry with a very wide audience base that's important for us to have a role with. The other thing is, for the last 30 plus years, we as a firm, together with the Urban Lands Institute, have issued the Emerging Trends in Real Estate publication, which is one of the most sought after thought leadership publications for the industry here in the US and around the world. And so for us, it's a very unique relationship, one that we've been a part of for a long time. And we also view it as very important to the industry functioning effectively.
That's been some of my winter reading pretty much as I entered the industry.
We're getting ready for the next one, Omar. So it's coming. We're getting ready to watch the next version.
Can you tell us, I guess, what is your scope within your practice and how does that fit into the broader PwC?
Yeah. So maybe starting at the overall firm level, you know, PwC is a global firm with operations in over 185 countries. We have over 400,000 people. We touch thousands and thousands of clients all over the world. And I'm in one piece of that in terms of my immediate business, and that I sit within our deals business, which is our transaction and events-driven business, covering everything from mergers and acquisitions to divestitures to capital raising to restructuring, strategy, valuation, accounting, reporting, and so on and so forth. And I think when you think about PwC, what differentiates us from others is one, we truly are a global business. So not only in the business that I run, where I sit on our global deals leadership team, where I interact with partners from all over the world that cover all the sectors, but all of our businesses, whether it's our audit franchise, which is incredibly strong, our tax franchise, which is world-class, but all of our businesses, whether it's audit, tax, deals, in our wider consulting business, truly operates as a global business. We talk globally, we operate globally, we operate with a network first mindset. And I think for us, why that differentiates us, because it's easy to say that, is we see things from different pockets of the world all the time before they happen in certain territories. So we may see something here in the US that impacts, you know, my partners and team in Europe and Asia, just like they in Europe and Asia or the Middle East or whatnot. They may see something that impacts us here. And that really is a differentiating to operate at the speed with which we need to operate at that scale is pretty special. And I think it's easy for firms to say they're global. It's another thing to operate on a day-to-day basis, you know, with the global mindset. I think that's the way we do things. And it's a pretty special place to be for that reason.
I could see that global network of just within PwC being very valuable in terms of serving a global asset class that is huge. So I guess if you were to elaborate a little bit more, what type of solutions are you offering to clients typically? Or what problems are you solving for them?
Yeah, just to be helpful to start with the types of businesses that we're interacting with, which kind of informs some of the outcomes. So the businesses we touch are private equity firms, sovereign wealth funds, foreign pensions, real estate investment trusts, real estate service providers, family offices, endowments, corporate occupiers, and the like. So it's a very wide audience base. And we think about running the business in terms of outcomes we're generating. For us, it's all about outcomes. And so, you know, it's not just the deal that's being done or the technology that's being implemented or the tax structure that needs to be put in place or the tax return that needs to be filed or the audit report that needs to be issued. It's ultimately, why does all that stuff need to happen? And at the end of the day, all those things are being done to generate outcomes for clients, whether it's generate returns for pensions that are investors in private equity firms, or, you know, ensure the stability of family wealth in the context of a family office, or generate returns for public company shareholders, or meet compliance obligations. There's always an outcome attached to everything we do, which is the why the client's asking for it in the first place. And that's really kind of what we're trying to do. And the range of things is quite considerable. And that, I think, when you think about it, is also a distinguishing part of a firm like PwC. And the part why I'm here is we do operate in a very integrated way. So for us, it's not just, you know, getting a transaction done. It's what happens after the transaction's done in terms of what's the value creation plan for generating the returns that we underwrote and so on and so forth. So that's kind of how we think about it, if that's helpful.
That is very helpful. And I think it sounds like you touched the entire ecosystem, which in every aspect of the ecosystem might have different challenges or different problems that they're solving for. But I think you did a good job of boiling down of ultimately you're trying to get the desirable outcome for each kind of unique situation. But one of the things that I was super excited to have you on today is because you just released the U.S. Deals 2025 Mid-Year Outlook for Real Estate. Can you tell us a bit about this report, as well as who is it intended for?
Yeah, so I sit as part of the wider firm's deals business. And so we have partners like me who sit over all of the sectors. And a number of years ago, we made the decision that it was important to give our clients, the people that I was just referring to, visibility into what we're seeing. I mean, one of the extraordinary privileges that we have, and in particular that I have in my role, is we see a lot of stuff, right? Because if we're all over the world, we touch all these different clients. They're looking at things all in different ways. Some of them are in some geographies than others. Some of them have some products that others don't have. And so we have the ability, we sit in the middle of all that. And so the idea of the report is to give people just a sense of how we're feeling and where we think the world is going. And we're going to make bold statements. And sometimes we may be wrong in those statements. But that's what we're trying to do, is just give people a lens into how we're feeling and where we think things are going and what we think potential risks and issues are. And that's what the objective is. And we do that for real estate, but we also do it for all industry sectors, which incidentally enough is actually very important for real estate, because a lot of what's happening in those other sectors informs what happens in real estate. So from my perspective, spending time with our partners that look after those is an important part of my role, to make sure that I'm seeing what they're seeing and understand it.
One of the things that you noted that you are seeing in the report is green shoots. And you mentioned some cautious optimism, but still optimism, which I think the current environment that we've gone through for the last 6 months has been one really painted with quite a bit of uncertainty. But what are some of those indicators or the data points that give you confidence in that cautious optimism tone?
Yeah, look, I think number one is, the benchmark 2021 was a year going back, 4 years. It's incredible to think that was 4 years ago now, where deal activity was just incredible, not just in real estate, but across every sector. And, since that time, there's been a lot of things that have happened in the external environment, whether it's geopolitical factors, macro factors, et cetera, that have changed the landscape a bit. But we always knew that we were going to come down from that level, because it was a level that was just, from our perspective, unsustainable. And granted, there's always a question of, how far we went down. And we think when you look at really at the fourth quarter of last year, that's when we kind of really had a lot of conviction that we reached the bottom and that we were going to start working our way back up from there. Now, would we have liked to see it go faster? Sure. Do we think that it will go faster? Yes. What are the things that we think will do that? Number one is, which we have now, we have stability in the interest rate environment. Yes, rates are higher. Yes, rates are going to be higher for longer. Yes, they're not going to go back to where they were, but investors understand where interest rates are. And in some pockets of the world, to be honest, Omar, rates are going down faster than they are here in the U.S. And in Asia, as an example, they're actually quite low relative to other parts of the world. And there's a lot of activity in places like Japan and the like. So we feel the interest rate environment is in part driving the green shoots. Two is inflation stability. We just had an inflation print recently that was around 2%, which is around the mandate level. So inflation is coming under control here in the United States and also kind of around the world. So, having a more clear outlook on where inflation is a good thing, because it has an impact on interest rates. There seems to be health in the consumer, actually resiliency in the consumer, particularly certain segments. There's challenges in some segments, but there's a lot of stability in other segments as well. So the macro environment is in a much different spot. And yes, it's a complicated environment where there's a lot of uncertainty, but that's always going to be the case. And so just a more stability in the environment, coupled with the amount of capital, is why we're so confident and have a lot of conviction around the green shoots be there. Now, in terms of where it's going, look, the what's considered to be investable commercial real estate is widening. And we've been saying this point for some time now, that there's a widening of what's considered to be investable real estate. And, you know, it used to be people put capital in office, retail, multifamily, industrial, and hospitality. I would say that those are like the legacy asset classes at this point. Still very important to the functioning of the economy. But the what people are focused on from an investment perspective is much, much broader. The amount of activity in student housing is quite significant. The amount of activity in cold storage is quite significant. In fact, the largest IPO since 2017 was in the cold storage space last year. A lot of activity in senior housing. There's incredible things going on in sports and live entertainment with entertainment districts. And I would be remiss if we didn't talk about data centers, right? Because we got to talk about data centers. So digitalization of the economy, it's happening, it's real. And so when you look at it through that lens, where you look at a broad lens of all these different pockets where people can put money that are being driven by really enduring trends, there's actually a lot to be optimistic about. And so that's why we frame it as green shoots. Now, it's cautious because there's things that could change that with just the amount of complexity that's out there. But there's a lot to be optimistic about when you look at what's happening.
Absolutely. And on that, you mentioned data centers, because I think that very much ties into kind of the bigger merge that's happening in terms of data centers are really kind of forcing this issue of how wide should this CRE scope be, given that if you look at a data center, if it's a CRE expert looking at it, they'll say that's CRE. If you look at somebody from infra or infrastructure looking at it, they'll say that's definitely infrastructure. And I think data centers are, and is a point that you call out in that report, is that they're bringing together these distinct asset groups into the CRE realm. And you do note that there's a lot of momentum there. And is that something you do see continuing? What do you think is going to carry that momentum forward?
Yeah, it's such an important point, Omar, to raise and to spend some time on. Without question, the line between real estate and infrastructure has blurred. And in some respects, you could view it as one asset class that we can just call real assets. But for this, let's just talk about real estate and infrastructure. And you've seen some of the largest investors in the world, whether it be private equity firms, sovereign wealth funds, foreign pensions, and beyond, form real assets groups or combine their real estate and infrastructure. And when you ask the question of why is that happening, the way that I like to think about it is, one, we're in an environment where interest rates are going to be higher for longer. Growth is maybe going to be slower than it has been. And so inflation is higher than it has been. And so what you really want in that kind of environment is stable cash flowing assets that produce a reasonable rate of return above the risk-free rates over that time period. And many people would refer to that as more infrastructure-like thinking. And so that's one reason why it's happening. The second reason why it's happening is when you look at what's driving the global economy, whether it be things like digitalization that we just talked about, or you want to talk about things like the energy transition, or you bring up themes like resilient supply chains, a lot of those investable opportunities have infrastructure-like characteristics and real estate characteristics. And so you kind of think about them together. And in fact, in some cases, you can have what maybe was a traditional infrastructure-like investment and a real estate investment. The example I use is all over the United States, you have these manufacturing facilities being developed in places like Arizona and Tennessee and Ohio and the like, Indiana. And so when you think about those big manufacturing facilities, you start to ask yourself the question, okay, the people that work in those facilities need a place to eat. They need a place to live. Chances are people are going to be visiting those locations and need a place to stay. And so you almost have this like mixed use ecosystem where different market participants, you know, want to play, or maybe the same firm wants to play, but different pools of capital. And so that's a reason why it's happening. Without question, we have a lot of conviction that's continuing. We think that's where the world is going, and we've seen the market move in that direction.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, the question of what business model and what benchmarks are really going to guide this real asset landscape. One of the big themes that you highlighted in the report has to do with strategic consolidation. I love your discussion around it, and you pointed out that this is strategic consolidation rather than standard cyclical recovery. I thought that was very well said. Can you expand on that? First of all, what's the distinction between strategic consolidation and a standard cyclical recovery? And what does it mean for deal structures, pricing, or just how CRE transacts going forward?
Yeah, so it's another really important topic and an important question. So the way that we like to think about it is, what's the why behind why it's happening? And the why behind this one for us is what's happening with capital. And so if you think about capital of traditional real estate investors, you had these separate ecosystems. You had private companies and you had public companies, right? You had one, and you were one or the other. Over the last number of years, the private ecosystem has become much, much more important. And the number of public companies that generates, you know, most of their return from the S&P 500 over the last like 15 to 20 years. I could be wrong, but it's something like 3% of companies. So if you're somebody that's investing capital and you're trying to generate a return for retirement or what have you, a lot of it is happening in the private markets. And so there's been this migration to the private markets from the public markets. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not a role for public markets. Clearly there is. But there's much more focus on private companies. That's number one. The second thing within the private markets ecosystem, investors want simplicity, right? So if I'm investing in the private markets, I don't want to have to go and look at 15, 20, 20 different managers. I just want maybe one, maybe two, maybe three that kind of offer me a range of different alternatives to invest in. So I may want to invest in opportunistic real estate. I may want to invest in core real estate. I want to invest in private credit. I want to invest in growth equity. I want to invest in private equity. I want to invest behind the energy transition. I want to invest behind impact. And so to do all those things, you need to have scale. And so, you know, a lot of why strategic consolidation is happening is to have scale in all those areas to meet the demand from investors. So that's why it's happening. The third reason why it's happening is we just launched a new brand a couple of weeks ago within the firm across the world. And one of our flagship parts of a brand relaunch was something we call value in motion. And when you think about what we're saying with the value in motion campaign, what we're saying is that across industry sectors are converging. And there's a lot of different industries that are coming together that historically were separate. And I think when you look at what we're talking about here today, one of the best examples you can look to is what's happening with insurance company and insurance companies in private markets, and what's happening with lending activities in private markets, where you see the largest firms, in some cases, choosing to buy insurance companies, right? Where there's examples of that. In other cases, choosing to be more asset light, but partnering with insurance companies or partnering with banks. And so that's why those three things in the aggregate are why we think this strategic consolidation is happening and why it's going to continue. Now, one more point I want to make, Omar, that I think it's important just to be clear about what our view is. that doesn't mean, as I already mentioned, that there won't be a role for public companies. That there for sure will still be a role for private companies. It also doesn't mean that there won't be smaller market participants that operate in a niche, right? And so we think it's almost like this barbell. There's like there's the ones who have multi one-stop shops for multiple products, and then you've got smaller folks who are very niche. Well, that's because of deal size or asset class or geography where there's not the scale where it makes sense for larger folks there. And so that's what we see happening, and we think that's going to continue.
That makes sense. So there's being there, scale is one way of competing, but then also specialization is there's still room for specialization. And as you mentioned, the kind of the niche operators. And I could see that particularly in, I would say, either smaller asset classes where scale can't fully be deployed. Am I thinking about that the right way?
Could be scale in an asset class where there's the amount of just the addressable market is not large enough. It could be a geography. There's certain pockets of the world. If you look at an area of the world, think about parts of Latin America as an example, where it may not be large enough of a market for certain market participants to go in. And there's a role for niche operators. So it could be asset class, could be geography, or it could just be size of opportunity. I mean, look, there's a lot of asset classes that trade at a couple million dollars, $10 million, $20 million. It doesn't make sense for some people. And so there's a role for niche players in that regard as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The one area that I'm curious if there is more scale is office to residential conversions. One thing that you highlighted in the report is that if you look at it in terms of percentage terms, you've been just seeing these really take off. But, you know, it's still measured in the couple hundred of either completed or planned to be completed. What's driving that, as well as is there still room to go? And is that a kind of going to be its own niche within a niche sector?
So look, one of the reasons I went into real estate, why I stayed in it for as long as I have, is real estate investors are incredibly creative people, right? And so with that kind of mindset, people will find a way to do interesting things with assets that are overlooked. And that's true with office conversions. Now, is the question, do we think that the available office to residential conversions will solve the acute challenge that we have with housing here in the United States and around the world? The answer is no. One, because just the supply of buildings that you can convert into rental housing won't generate the yield in terms of units that will solve that challenge, which is in the millions of units. It's also, in many cases, it's the conversions don't make sense. When you look at the economics, just the cost to reconfigure the asset, the floor plates, et cetera, just doesn't work. So we don't think it's going to solve the housing challenge that we have. And, you know, we think that that is, in fact, true. We have a lot of conviction behind that. But do we think that there's a lot of interesting investment opportunities to take underutilized assets and convert them into something else? Absolutely. Do we expect that we can continue to see it? Absolutely. Just look at where we were with retail. Some people say it's just like retail. Others say it's not like retail. It's probably somewhere in the middle. It's part like retail. It's part not. But there's a lot of parallels. And so when you think about retail, people are like, what's going to happen with all these shopping centers around the world? Well, look what's happened to them. All these interesting things have happened with those assets. And now some of the most sophisticated capital is going back into retail. We comment on one of the transactions in our report that we public to private transaction that we saw in the retail space. But just years ago, just, you know, 18, 24 months ago, people were saying, we're never going to go back into retail. People will find a way to do interesting things with these opportunities. It could be converting them into a hotel, could be converting them into a data center, converting them into lab facilities. People will find a way. And so the overall conversion theme, we think, is more of a value add, opportunistic type of strategy that has role in an overall portfolio. And so we think that certainly will be part of where capital goes moving forward.
And if the real estate industry is creative, flexible, and pretty adaptable, I know there's been a lot of proposed policy changes, whether it's on the tax side of bonus depreciation or 1031 exchanges or opportunity zones, LIHTC. Which ones are you paying attention to the most, and how do you think that they will impact the industry as a whole?
Yeah, it's a really important topic, Omar, because if you look at it with what you, the administration and Congress are endeavoring to do, you know, they're trying to make people's lives better and they're trying to reduce the amount of regulation and they're trying to find ways to get our deficits under order, which by any standard, our deficits here in the United States are too high at the moment. So something has to be done on the tax front to solve that. So it's a very important topic. Now, the question as part of any legislation like that is always, if you're going to cut rates for people to make their lives better, there needs to be offsets and revenue raisers, right? And there's always a dialogue around that. And that's a discussion, and lots of different industries have different views. And real estate's no different than any other industry in that regard. What was concerning to many, including the real estate roundtable we spoke about earlier, was certain things that were being proposed early on, things around carried interest, things around not being able to expense the property taxes if you're a business, like-kind exchanges, deduction for pass-through enterprises, which you mentioned, bonus appreciation. There's a lot of things that were on the table as potential revenue raisers that were very concerning from a real estate investment perspective. The one that we were most focused on, which you at least at the moment is not in the legislation, was the not being eligible to deduct property taxes as a business, which would have had a very detrimental effect on real estate investment. So we'll see what happens. It's obviously going through the Senate as we speak. Other things we're keeping a close eye on are, there's a rule referred to as Section 899, which is around foreign capital investment. We already have for real estate, we already have the FIRPTA regime, which applies to the Foreign Investment Real Property Tax Act, which applies to foreign investors. We've been trying for some time to try to adjust the FIRPTA regime. Section 899 would be an additional burden in that regard. So that's one that we're paying close attention to see what happens, for the reason that it could have the impact of impacting cross-border capital flows, which we need in real estate. We need the cross-border capital. So that's probably the most significant one that we're still keeping an eye on at this stage.
That makes sense. And I know a lot of that is, I would say, TBD, right? In terms of, we haven't seen anything fully go through, at least as of the recording. But the turning attention to kind of the outlook, your report, you did mention that you do see quite a bit and significant value in motion and have expectations that deal activity will pick up. Where specifically do you see this kind of value creation happening over the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah. Let me answer that, Omar, from two different perspectives. One is, when we think of the word value creation, what we're really thinking about is, what are going to be the long-term generators of returns moving forward? You know, when you're in an environment where the cost of capital is so low, some of those things may not be as important, right? But in this environment we're in now, where we know for certain that interest rates are going to be higher for longer, whatever period of time, and probably not going back to where they were, you're going to need to have new levers to pull to generate returns in the whatever benchmark you have. And so the importance of having the right operational business plan is going to be certainly part of the lexicon, much more visible part of the lexicon and strategy of investors moving forward across the patch. And so when you think about that, then in terms of what does that mean in terms of the outlook, it means that you're probably going to see more activity in those asset classes that are more operationally intensive, because you need levers to pull. So I'll go back to my example, like cold storage. That's an example. We expect to see more activity in hospitality, senior living. These are all sectors that are operationally intensive. And we think that we're going to see activity because of this value creation on it. In addition to that, if you go back to some of the things we talked about before, the digitalization of the economy, just whether it's AI or just the proliferation in data, the number of handheld devices, there's no question the digital infrastructure as a investable asset has an incredible enduring trends behind it and continue. We think we'll still see a lot of activity there. There's some concern that it's maybe by the end of the decade, we start to run into some supply pressure in that sector. Let's see what happens, right? These trends are very hard to predict just how fast they're moving. But there's a lot of strength behind that. So we think we'll see more there. Housing, look, whichever way you want to cut, if you want to look at student housing, if you want to look at multifamily, if you want to look at multifamily, there's not enough affordable housing or housing in general for people. And so that we think we'll continue to see a lot of momentum in. And then the final thing I'll mention is just around the changing of kind of supply chains and the like is going to trigger a lot of investment activity. And that some of it is related to the energy transition. Some of it has to do with reshoring and building additional resilient supply chain. So all those areas are pockets where we think we'll continue to see a lot of investment activity moving forward in terms of our outlook.
And in terms of technology, because I think that's a driving theme across sectors, but also is something that can ultimately change up the business model within those sectors. How are you seeing new technology being adopted by CRE firms? So kind of like the owners and operators. And is that flowing through at all into kind of the transaction environment and affecting maybe deals that either due diligence processes or potentially how fast deals get executed?
Yeah. And the way you frame that question is so important, Omar, because I think sometimes what we see is technology being viewed as a means to an end. Right? And really, it's technology is just an enabler of driving the underlying operations of the business. And so what we do see is shifts in operating models significantly for the reasons we talked about. Could be because we need more scale, could be because we're trying to go into a new geography, could be because we have industry convergence. So the operating models are changing. And so because the operating models are changing, you need technology solutions that enable that business to run the right way. And so without a doubt, within commercial real estate, across those different cohorts of market participants I mentioned it earlier in the session, we see technology being implemented at a greater scale and with more pace than we've seen it in some time. In addition to that, you know, one of the things that commercial real estate firms and real estate firms in general have is a lot of data on tenants, on assets, and the like. And the question is, do we really know everything about our assets that we think we know? And do we have it all in one place? And is it of the right quality? And is it standardized? In a lot of cases, the answer to those questions are no. So we see a lot of energy around just data investments, which has a technology implication to it. One, because it's needed to truly leverage AI in the right way. Without the right data, you can't really utilize AI in the right way. But the other thing is, if you think about value creation plans, you need data to understand what some of those levers are. And so there's a lot of activity around data. So other market participants, particularly in the venture capital space, have been pounding this drum for a while around, you know, that the real estate industry has been slow to adopt technology. I think that's true. I think that the landscape's changed and there's a lot more attention on it. And we think it's only going to continue from here at scale, for sure.
And so this has been a very insightful conversation. I have two questions for you. First is, how can folks follow you, PwC, your group, or ultimately read the report?
Yeah. So for me and my partner specifically, we're all on LinkedIn. So that's one way you can follow us. Two, I think you're going to put a link to the report in the webcast. That's a way you can get access to the report for my sector, real estate industry, and also access all of our sectors. We also do this at a global level, which will be coming in the next several weeks as well. So you can get links to both the US version and the global version through that same channel, on through the link that you'll publish it on our website if you can't find it there.
Awesome. The final question I have is something that we ask all of our guests. If you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would that be?
That's a big question. Listen, I don't know that there's a change in the industry that I would like to see happen. I think what I would highlight is just how important this industry is to the functioning of the global economy. And so it's through shows like your show, where you're shining a spotlight on what's happening in the industry, that's so important, because it really is real assets are a backbone to the efficient functioning of every industry around the world. And so for me, having that be the framework for how people see the industry would be my wish.
Excellent. Tim, thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have, but thank you for joining, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.